This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and a great conversation in our first hour about the three studies now, three major studies coming out showing that white voters, the more economically insecure they were, the more worried they were about their future economically, the more concerned they were about their kids' student loans, the more concerned they were about their own ability to pay their mortgage, the more concerned they were about their own credit card debt, the more likely they were to vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Whereas the people who were concerned that black people were coming to get them represented a threat to their safety, or that brown people were trying to get their jobs represented a threat to their economic safety, or that women in the workplace represented a threat to them. We're talking that roughly 35% of the electorate that are white men. Those white men who fell into that category, or who just explicitly held animus, a bias, a hatred, a dislike for people of color or for women, they were the ones who voted for Donald Trump. That race and misogyny were the principal things that drove people to vote for Donald Trump. And then what they used as the excuse for that vote was, well, you know, he said he's going to protect my Social Security and my Medicare. He said he's going to protect my job and bring the jobs back. He said he's going to get manufacturing jobs back in America. He said he's going to give us all national health care at a lower price than Obamacare. He said everybody's going to be covered. Everybody's going to have health insurance. He said our wages are going to go up. I mean, he's not doing any of those things. In fact, he's doing the opposite of most of them. He said that he would raise taxes on rich people. Remember? He said, I'm going to get killed with this one. Instead, he did the exact opposite. He raised taxes on working people, lowered taxes on rich people. He raised taxes on working people not by actually raising the federal tax code, but by cutting federal taxes and doing away with deductibility of state taxes in a way that is going to cause states to start charging people fees and the federal government to start charging people fees for pretty much everything that happens, which is a backward way of tax. So that was our first hour, just to recap it. In the second hour, we can continue our conversation on those topics. And, you know, where it all came from and where it's all going and all that, and, you know, and the Kavanaugh part of our conversation in our first hour as well. But there's a large issue that almost never gets discussed in the mainstream media. And I think it's a really, really important one, and that is the possibility of human extinction and the certainty, the reality all around us, and the ongoing reality of the extinction of higher order animals, mammals, vertebrates, you know, just the whole thing. As a consequence of both climate change and the fact that we're like 7.6 billion human beings on Earth. There was an editorial published in the journal Science last Friday. The chief scientist of the National Geographic Society, Jonathan Bally, and the chief scientist of the Chinese Academy of Scientists, biologist Yaping Zhang, were the authors of this. And they are explicitly saying, if we want to stop a major extinction crisis, which might include the extinction of the human race, because we do depend upon the natural world for our survival. If we want to stop this major extinction crisis, they say, we need to set aside half of the planet for wild. For wild species, wild plants, wild animals, wild everything. The planet's lungs, the planet's kidneys, these are wild areas. And that's not how we're doing it. In fact, this is, I have the editorial here. They start out how much of the planet should we leave for other forms of life, they ask. We're 7.6 billion people now, we're heading for 10 billion. The demands for food and water will more than double by 2050. And then they point out 20% of the world's vertebrates and plants are threatened with extinction. Livestock now constitutes 60% of the biomass, the mammalian biomass on the planet. Livestock, animals being grown to be food for human beings, represents 60% of all mammals on the planet, on a mass, on the the percentage of the mass biomass. Humans represent 36%. So as a single species, we're the largest source of protoplasm on the planet. Our feedstock, our animals that we eat, are number two. And only 4% of the biomass on the planet is represented by the over 5,000 species of wild mammals. Wild vertebrate populations, they say, have declined by more than 50% since 1970. And most scientific studies, and there have been a bunch of them recently that have come out on this, say that to safeguard biodiversity and preserve ecosystem benefits, we have to have between 25 and 75% of our major ecosystems protected, and from human development, human this, human that. But just less than half of the Earth's surface remains relatively intact, and that tends to be much less productive. And only 3.6% of the oceans and 14% of our land are actually explicitly protected. So they're saying that we should convene a conference on biological diversity and do something about this. I'm all in favor of that. I'm very skeptical that anything is going to be done, which concerns me. On the other hand, I had this idea the other day that I think that, I was thinking, okay, what if we were to wipe out the entire human race through global extinction, right? Through, climate change and disease or whatever it is. It occurred to me that this is a somewhat Cartesian view, but I think that it's valid nonetheless, that the intelligence, the intellect that you and I are experiencing right now, the brain, the mind, the thinking processes that we're using, that I'm using to express these ideas, that you're using to understand them and translate them into things meaningful to you, that all of that is the predictable and logical and normal result of a neurological system, a brain, reaching a certain level of complexity. Our brains have a certain level of complexity, and that complexity, and so the question I'm asking is it possible that when any living system reaches that level of complexity, does something like human consciousness just naturally emerge? Because it's a function of the complexity of the system. And does that mean that as we become more complex, as we continue to evolve, and it does appear that the brain complexity is increasing and then humans are evolving, does that mean that our form of consciousness will change? And is that for the better or for the worse? And does that mean similarly that if humans were wiped out, and let's say the lizards once again ruled the earth, but they got to be the size of a dinosaur and their brains became as complex as ours, that our consciousness would then become the dinosaur's consciousness? Only they wouldn't be dinosaurs. They would be modern day, whatever you call them. But is it just inevitable? Are we just part of a continuum? For that matter, is the entire universe as a neural system, the planets interact with each other principally through gravity, but also through the other forces, the strong force, the weak force, the electromagnetic force. Is it possible that the entire planet is at already a level of complexity that causes it to be the giant brain of everything, that it is expressing consciousness? And then also the question, if the computer systems of this planet that are increasingly wired to each other by the internet, or if an individual supercomputer were to reach the level of complexity of the human brain, and we're nowhere close to that right now, but if it were, would our kind of consciousness emerge there? And if so, there's two giant variables that modify our way of understanding consciousness. One is our need to eat. And I suppose for a giant computer, that would be the need for electricity. And the other is our need to reproduce, which drives all kinds of crazy behavior that is constantly getting people in trouble. But these are biological urges that are born into us. Does a computer have the equivalent of that? The desire to seed little viruses all over in other computers all over that could become conscious just like it. I don't know the answer to these questions, but this is the stuff that, you know, sometimes I'm awake at night looking up at the ceiling going, this is the, sorry to inflict it on you. But anyhow, these are some of the thoughts. So, you know, I'm going to toss it to you for, you know, thoughts on all of these things that we've been talking about. We've been talking about Kavanaugh. We've been talking about who's voting for Trump. What does this mean for the future of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? What does it mean for the future of the Republic, for that matter? And, you know, what about human extinction? Is it possible? Should we set aside half the planet for wild? And if we go away, does our consciousness remain? Kind of an Edgar Cayce idea.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lots of stuff to discuss. We'll pick up your calls after this. It's 17 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. You know, it's the whole mode, I guess, where I'm driving at a lot of this.
Stop for just a second. What's the subject? What's the frame? What's the context in which you're speaking?
You don't necessarily have to. I mean, they hate black and brown people, but anybody that doesn't fit the character of the wealthy upper class or whatever, they just don't accept anything for anybody else. And, you know, they're horrible against the real hardcore black people and everybody else. But they're also deplorable to even their own kind sometimes.
What is a hardcore black person? What are you talking about? Me, says Nate.
What I'm saying is, I mean, they're hardcore against the African-American or the black
people. Oh, you mean the white attitudes are hardcore against black people. I get it. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I'm talking about, you know, there's a small group of people. I experienced it in my own family. My grandparents were horrible. They had this attitude that nobody that dressed or act or did anything like they did just didn't fit into the picture.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole, you know, how does bias play out is a very real thing, and one that's, you know, we just have to be aware of it. You know, last week I was reading a novel that had a couple of characters in it, and one of them had a very thick Southern accent, and you know, I used to make fun of Southern accents. I got really good at imitating Gomer Pyle when I was a kid, and that was like, you know, a way of saying stupid. And that had nothing to do with race. That was about, you know, stupid white Southerners, right? Gomer Pyle was a white guy, and last week, I guess it's Saturday, I was still kind of talking like this one character in this novel that I'd been reading, and it was like, wait a minute, where'd that come from? You know, and you know, it's my own. I guess all of us, you know, people who talk differently than we do, we think are different than us, just like people who look differently than we do, we think are different than us. And somehow we have to focus on the fact that, you know, underneath it all, we're really all largely the same. And
so why does this thinking keep proliferating itself? It's like a poison. It's a drop in the water, and it spreads through the masses, and it just... Yeah. It confuses the bejesus out of me.
Well, maybe I should, you know, I said earlier we have two basic instincts, to eat and to produce offspring, you know, to spread our DNA. You know, I probably should add a third one to that, and that is to protect our family, to be safe and to keep safe the people who we perceive to be biologically similar to us. I mean, using the Richard Dawkins selfish gene theory, that it's all about propagating the gene pool, and you know, that impulse is the basis of racism. It's also the basis of, you know, mother and father instinct and family instinct, which we would all argue is good, but it's like a scalpel. It can heal or it can wound, and these are doing all these things. But I'm not sure that just wringing our hands about it, Rich, is what we need to be doing. We need to figure out how to directly respond to it. Rich, thanks for the call. Thoughtful question. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And, oh, by the way, it's Nate's birthday. He's permanently 29, right? Yeah. There you go. Happy birthday to the Virgo on our staff. Sean's a Capricorn, aren't you? Oh, you're a Taurus, and I'm a, that's right. You're just a couple days away from me, and I'm a Taurus. We got a bunch of earth signs here in the room. I'm not sure what Shura is. Do you know? Does anybody know? Capricorn. Oh, my God. We're all earth signs. Okay. Figure that one out. Larry in Loganville, Georgia. It says you disagree with me here, Larry. About what?
Well, I just see that you have a definite hate for our president and certainly a biased way of discussing anything that throws a negative connotation on anything that he's done or hasn't been able to do through no fault of his own. I mean, he does not necessarily rule this country. We have a Congress that a large segment of it tries to thwart any progress he makes towards completing his campaign promises that you just so magnanimously implied that he has not completed any of, which is another false.
Well, let's see. Donald Trump said that he was going to give us all health insurance at a lower cost than Obamacare, and it would cover everybody in the United States.
And
instead,
Democrats,
his administration is...
Wait a minute. You're interrupting. Let me take them one at a time. All and right. The Congress, the Democratic Congress, and some of the Republicans have fought him tooth and nail because they're afraid to abolish Obamacare 100%.
The Republicans control Congress here. You don't get to blame this, Larry, on the Democrats. The Republicans control the House. They control the Senate. They can pass anything they want. Look at the tax cut that they just passed.
Sir, you're not letting me speak.
That's, you know, Larry, you don't have an absolute right to speak.
Well,
if you want to have a conversation with me, I'm happy to have a conversation with you. If you're going to yell at me about how I'm running the show, I'm going to move on to the next caller.
See, in other words, you're just going to cut me off. Because you can't.
No, I'm going to interrupt you when I think that you're spouting BS. The fact of the matter is that the Republicans.
What do you do to you?
Good luck. The fact of the matter is that the Republicans have not taken up Trump's promise of national health care for all. In fact, they're doing the opposite.
Did I not state that some of the Republicans did not want to abolish Obamacare? I did not say just the Democrats.
Abolishing Obamacare doesn't get us a national health care program, Larry. It just gets us more unemployed people.
Well, sir,
or uninsured, excuse me.
The Affordable Care Act, as it's written, will bankrupt this country.
No, the Affordable Care Act, as it's written, saves us several hundred billion dollars a year, and that is acknowledged by Republicans as well as Democrats.
No, it does not.
Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, it does, and it has.
No, it does not.
You can say no, it does not all day long, but you're opposing the Congressional Budget Office and independent analyses. I mean, even when the Koch brothers did their analysis of the cost of single payer, they concluded that the Affordable Care Act has reduced costs temporarily. Now it's temporary because the Republicans keep drilling holes in it.
So you're comparing it against something that doesn't exist.
Okay, we're discussing this to death, this health insurance. Let's move on to another one of Trump's promises. Another one of his promises was that he was going to protect Social Security and Medicare. His budget this year calls for a $1.7 trillion cut in all programs that provide anything for anybody who makes less than $100,000 a year, on top of a $1.5 trillion boost for people who make more than $100,000 a year. And specifically, he's cut hundreds of millions of dollars out of the budget in the last budget that he signed. He signed legislation that cut hundreds of millions of dollars out of the budgets of Social Security and Medicare, and they're proposing a $260 billion cut in Social Security and Medicare for the year coming up that starts October 1st. Not a single Democrat is participating
in this.
Where did
this all come from?
From the Republican Party. This was Paul Ryan's budget.
Okay,
and Donald Trump is
on board with this?
Donald Trump is totally on board with it. Democrats, no. The Democrats are saying, no, we don't want to cut Social Security or Medicare. Trump is on the stump speech. He's saying the Democrats want to cut it. He is lying through his teeth, Larry. He's lying through his teeth.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Sorry for the break, Larry, but I have no control over those at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back It's 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Ryan in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I remember you're asking the question about how we defeat Trump, and I think it's, you know, there's many different ways that we can go about it, but definitely it reminds me of the coalition that the blacks and the whites formed in like the 1920s ish. When unions were actually first starting in the South, they got together. It didn't matter if they were race, and they got together and they unionized, and they formed labor coalitions. Mm-hmm. and that's how we defeat Trump. That's how we defeat, you know, people on the right. We support labor, whether it's through workplace co-ops or unions.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. The biggest problem I think that labor has right now is that a good chunk of their workers are watching Fox News, and they're getting indoctrinated into this corrupt unions nonsense, and it's just breathtaking. But your point is really well made, Ryan. Thank you very much. I broadly speaking, I agree with you. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey. Got a wound up a while ago with a few different things there. I'd like to, if I may, come back to your comments about the shape of the earth and our relationship to it and mm-hmm. the economy that could. Yeah, this has been known for a long time. We need to regrow the forest, keep our farmland fertile, and expand that base, taking care of our watersheds in particular. And, you know, the way to do this, one way, is with hemp, to be a helper, not a silver bullet, but a helper. It helps. It helps the farmer.
I think Nate just won a bet here. How many seconds would it take before Bob? Oh, Sean won the bet before Bob from Tahlequah mentions hemp. By the way, well, Bob, it's Nate's birthday today. Happy birthday to Nate.
Happy birthday, Nate. Happy birthday to you. Okay. Yeah, we've been working on this issue for years and years, and we were working on nuclear issues, and we were working on water quality issues in Arkansas. The beautiful Illinois River flows from Arkansas here.
So do you have legalized hemp in Oklahoma yet?
It's stifled with the chicken industry that pollutes the water.
Yeah.
And, and so what I'm saying is relevant. We could get a lot, we could get other scientists and people to talk about it from OSU, perhaps. We're now picking up the ball there.
Yeah, but we've got a ways to go, Bob. We've got a lot. Bob, I got to move along, but we've got a long ways to go. Great to hear from you, Pam in Chicago. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Let me just eliminate this noise. How are you?
I am well. What's up?
Okay, good. Tom, I wanted to talk about this. You want?
Pam, you just faded out. I'm not sure.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
You can hear me now, Tom?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry about that. You always put so many things on the table. I want to talk about race, but then also I wanted to talk about the Democratic Party and the effectiveness of their organization, particularly when it comes to other ethnic groups, African Americans in particular.
Okay.
So here's my concern. The Democratic Party has stopped doing things out of fear. So in other words, they won't talk about race because they're fearful of what that will do to Trump's party. They won't talk about impeachment because they're in fear of how that will generate the Republican Party. So how are you going to be effective if your message is always operating out of fear, or your strategy is determined based on the fear of what the opponents will do?
Yeah, I completely agree, and I would add one thing to that,
sure.
Pam, and that is that they're unwilling to talk about voter suppression and stolen elections because they're afraid that people will think, well, I guess my vote doesn't get counted, it doesn't matter, so I won't vote. And they've had that fear since the early 2000s. I've had Democratic senators express that fear to me as their excuse for refusing to discuss all the damage that the Republicans have done to our election system since 2001 with the Help America Vote Act. Back to you, Pam.
Exactly. And those are real, Tom, but not only that. So when I'm having conversations as a black person about the Democratic Party and what's going on within the system, you know, here in Chicago, Tom, we're dealing right now with the Laquan McDonald trial. Mm-hmm. The officer shot a black youth 16 times. That trial is going on right now. And then also we had a very prominent mayor, Rahm Emanuel, to announce he wasn't going to run. So now we have about 50 people in the election. And I'm only saying that because that race is probably going to be divided by race. But here's my concern. People among my circle, they say this. Well, you know, the Democratic Party takes us for granted. And the Republican Party ignores us. So maybe I should take a chance and vote Republican so that that will wake the Democratic Party up. Now, I don't subscribe to that because I didn't want Trump having the opportunity to appoint Supreme Court justices. And I knew that Trump was problematic. But when black people begin to feel like that, ignored, sometimes, Tom, you do things that aren't in your best interest, and particularly when it relates to race. And let me make my comment about that quickly. Tom, it is my feeling that if black people hated white people as much as they hated us, we perhaps would be much further along. But we try to follow the teachings of our civil rights leaders as well as our religious beliefs, that love conquers all, act in love, and then you will make a change. But it's hard to say that, Tom, when you have a president, for me it's clearly racist. The other black people, clearly racist, and continuously can just find it difficult that white people don't understand the hatred that is emanating from Trump. They don't understand it or they want to ignore it. And all I would ask, Tom, for those Republican supporters of Trump or middle-of-the-road Republicans, 53% of women supported him. That was shocking.
Yeah.
I would ask, Would they want their daughters to marry someone like Trump? Would they want their sons to be like Trump? And so I don't know how to make it any plainer that Trump is a racist. And if it's okay with you, then say that. Just it's okay, as long as we think that white people are empowered and getting more financial resources. As a black woman, I don't know what more black people can do. We've built this country. I looked at the image yesterday. I thought it was disgusting how underrepresented black people were, and other ethnic groups as well. Mm. So I feel like white people, you own everything, you control all the major systems, banking, education, finance, I mean, the legal system, law enforcement, and you won't do right. Tom, I wish more people would be of their thinking or have an openness about race. Because from what I see, Tom, I know it's from enslavement, but then also it's just the hatred of my black skin. Because you don't know anything else about me, assumptions or prejudices or biases. But just, so Tom, as a black woman, black people, we don't know what else to do. Now, if we act violently, then that's used as an excuse. Well, see, well, you know, of course they're savages because they've acted violently. But Tom, we're tired of trying to protest peacefully, march peacefully, trying to come to the table, have a conversation. How many more conversations about race can we have?
Well, it's going to have to be some more. I mean, you know, all of your points are really well taken. I am concerned. You know, where you said if black people hated white people as much as white people hate black people, I think that the percentage of white people who actively hate black people is actually quite small. The percentage of white people who don't understand or fear or simply view black people as the other is probably much, much larger. And the number of white people who are just happy to live in their white privilege and completely ignore issues that have to do with race because they have the luxury of doing that given where they live and how they live is probably huge. But, you know, these issues do have to be on the table. Pam, you raised a whole bunch of really good points, but I need to get other, you know, let some other people get
Tom,
into the conversation.
Can I add one more point?
Sure.
Tom, I don't know if your listeners, if they read some of societies of some of our black scholars, like a Dr. Asa Hilliard, Dr. John Henry Clark, or even some of the views of a Dr. Frances Press Welsing, who many disagree, but, you know, she has some interesting theories. So I would encourage people to do some reading about some of the black, by some of the black psychologists and some of the prolific writers about race. And then, Salim, I'm going to ask you this. Mr. Salim Wakil, when he would have very interesting discussions about race, because you all really have a lot of the information you're trying to get. Then lastly, Tom, let me ask you this. When you talk about...
Pam, your phone is breaking up really badly. I don't know if there's something you can do to stop that, but I'm only getting every other word.
Can you hear me now, Tom?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Keep on.
One last question about your statement. Tom, is there such thing as an artificial, if we talk about artificial intelligence, will we also then begin to talk about an artificial consciousness? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I don't know what to do with it. I just this idea that, you know, when things reach certain levels of complexity, certain things spontaneously happen. It's sort of a Van Leeuwenhoek theory of all this stuff. You know, Van Leeuwenhoek said that back in the 1600s that if you had a certain amount of hay, mice would spontaneously appear. So this, my Van Leeuwenhoek theory of consciousness.
To Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But these issues of race are deep and intractable and tragically are being exploited by Trump and the Republican Party and have been since the 1960s. And welcome back. Oh, let's see here. Linda in Seattle. Listening on 91.3 FM. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
I'm Linda, and I have the Eco Peace Vision YouTube channel, and I'm calling because I wanted to be a advocate for God, because I heard you say, you know, that, well, I actually have thought, like, you know, you have thought, you think now, up until 2014, when I took the time to listen to somebody who was disabled, waiting to get disability, and happened to have a very intuitive and tuned into God, and God became on my radar as a real consciousness that can talk in whole sentences. And I was holding a Bible at the time, and he said, I was saying, well, I don't know if God's really a he. I don't know if the Bible hasn't been changed over all these years. I had not at that time had my kids read it because of those concerns. And he said, I'm hearing to tell you to open it to Job 38. And I didn't know where that was. I was looking for the table of contents. And he said, I'm hearing to tell you to open it in the middle and turn a few pages. I opened it, and it was to Job, so I could easily find Job 38. That is where they've had three people, maybe four, have been having a conversation about God.
Mm-hmm.
And God shows up on the scene in Job 38. So that's, and God says, where were you when the universe was first surveyed? And he goes on to talk about being there when a deer births a baby deer. You know,
Linda, what's the point you're making?
So you had said, you know, that you had kind of, sometimes physicalize God, saying Father God. Well, Jesus called God Father God. Well, you had said, okay, he has like a physical body. Well, in the spiritual realm, my understanding from the same person that was able to tune in to a lot of things and relay them to me, that angels, ethereal beings, do not have the same physicality that humans have. They will present in a physical way depending on the dominant virtues that they're trying to relay.
Linda, you're describing for us your religious epistemology, your worldview. I'm not sure why.
Well, because you have you had made a statement about that monotheistic religions are problematic. And our,
yes.
I think if we will look at our laws and look at the Declaration and the, as I've researched into it recently, I'm working on writing something that the colonists that came over, they there was a group of 20,000 Puritans, 20,000 Protestants, you know, in a, you know, close time proximity. All the colonists, when they made the Declaration, they had, in 1740, they had this huge evangelical movement, awakening, they called it. So everybody knew about God in the Bible. That was,
And if you're talking about the founding generation, most of them were quite skeptical of God in the Bible, or many of them, you know, particularly Jefferson and Franklin. But Linda, I'm still not sure exactly where we're going here, other than you think that I'm knocking patriarchy and monotheism, and I guess I am. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and Loving What You Do, a new book by Ellen Ratner. On the line with us is Luke Vargas, the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, joins us from UN headquarters in New York. You can follow him on Twitter at The Courier. Luke, what's going on in the world today? New news about the Trump census?
Yeah, you may have remembered last year when Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was testifying in front of Congress defending why it was that a citizenship question was being added to the 2020 census, a move that many analysts and most researchers at the Census Bureau believe is going to cause an undercount as sort of mixed immigration status households decide it's too legally risky or perceive it to be too legally risky to even fill out the census. And that will deny funding and congressional representation to states with high immigrant populations. Wilbur Ross said, look, the reason we're doing this is because, quote, the Department of Justice initiated the request for inclusion of the citizenship question, end quote, in further testimony in front of the House, saying Commerce, quote, responded solely to the Department of Justice requests and that the Justice Department was, quote, the one who made the request. Well, it turns out new documents uncovered in a suit by the New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood, who's suing the administration over the addition of the citizenship question, finds that in the very, very early days of the administration, it was none other than Wilbur Ross and his top aides who came up with the idea of adding the citizenship questions. And they were the ones that went around to Justice and to the DHS to see what those agencies thought about the move. In both cases, early on in the Trump administration, Justice said, we don't think it's right to raise this question, and DHS punted it back to DOJ, saying, no, we don't have an opinion on this. It's up to DOJ to decide. Eventually, the Department of Justice does issue a memo saying that for reasons of enforcing the Voting Rights Act better, which I think is quite flimsy given how little attention Jeff Sessions has paid to voting rights issues, beyond quote-unquote voter fraud. What Wilbur Ross said is very misleading and perhaps could amount to perjury, that it was in fact his idea and it was not Department of Justice that thought this was a wise move. So again, we'll see. This could substantially undermine the federal government's defense of the citizenship question come December 5th, I believe, which is when this New York Attorney General's trial begins. So again, a bald-faced lie there from Commerce describing what I think many people believe is a brazenly political act to change the census, and Wilbur Ross pretending it was otherwise.
Remarkable. And Donald Trump, refugee admissions, he has apparently radically dialed back the number of refugees we're letting into this country.
Yeah, bear in mind, the last year of the Obama administration, we set a target of letting in 115,000 refugees. This is different from people who come to our border and apply for asylum. This is a much more orderly process where people, you know, put in their applications from overseas. President Trump comes into office. Last year, we see a target of 45,000. We're actually only going to admit about 25 of that. So these targets are not even being met right now. The new target for 2018-2019 fiscal year is 30,000. But again, gauging by the fact that we're only about 50% of our ceiling for this year, I think the expectation is we're going to have a much lower number than 30,000 people let in over the next calendar year. And I did some interviews on this. The administration will point to the fact that there's a backlog, that they have added new security checks, and that's the reason why this is getting tripped up. The experts I've talked to say that's not the case, including the head of the International Crisis Group in the U.S., who says this is bureaucratic strangulation, that the administration relishes
when one agency will put up a roadblock and say, oh, you know, DHS is taking a little longer here. Everyone else is going to have to wait for us. That in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, it's the president who needs to take the lead and clear those hurdles. And quite the contrary, the Trump administration celebrates whenever there's a single sticking point within the very laborious bureaucratic process of screening refugees. And the consequences of this, I think, are more than just America's moral standing. They are that conditions for refugees abroad deteriorate when countries do not have any confidence anymore that the U.S. generally supports the resettlement of refugees, and that it actually is domestically destabilizing to some of our allies like Lebanon or Jordan or Turkey, who are bearing a tremendous refugee burden, when they can no longer credibly tell the populations of those countries that, hey, I know we're shouldering a lot of refugees right now, but we've got allies in the U.S., in Europe, at the U.N., who are helping to move to process these refugee claims and resettle these people. When the U.S. removes that prospect of resettlement at the end of the line, it does weaken the standing of those governments to be able to quell anti-migrant or anti-refugee sentiment in those countries. And I'll finally point out the number, the composition of refugees is changing dramatically. We have let in now more Moldovans over the past calendar year as refugees to the U.S. than Syrians, and the population of Syrian refugees as a reference point is just as large as the entire population of Moldova. So it seems
are Moldovans white Europeans?
They certainly are, and President Trump loves more Norwegians to apply for refugee status. He's made his sort of racial opinions pretty well known on this matter.
Yeah, remarkable. And North and South Korea are meeting today without Trump. What's up with that?
The big thing we should watch for probably over the next 2-3 days, is there an announcement of a new location and time for the second Trump-Kim meeting? That's the big role for President Moon. That's what he needs to win for Trump in Pyongyang this week.
That's fascinating. Luke Vargas, The Courier on Twitter. Luke, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Sure enough. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News, talkmedianews.com. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and some a little update on Brett Kavanaugh right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.